Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 123 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
On today's show, we are honored to have Master of Wine, Lisa Granick. She's playing ambassador to the largest tasting of Georgian wines ever assembled in New York City, and in the U.S. for that matter. And that's the country, Georgia, not the state. Later in the show, we're going to give Lisa the most insignificant test of her life, the morning after quiz on the state of Georgia. But first...
And that's the state, not the country.
That's actually the state, not the country. But first, Miss Sari Kamen has some food news for us.
Speaking of the most insignificant something happening in the world. My food news today.
And well, Lisa, actually, of course, you know, please chime in.
Well, actually, I wanted to say, right before the show started, we found out that Lisa actually speaks Russian fluently. So for our listeners out there who speak only Russian and have been listening to the show, not understanding it for a long time, we finally have a solution. So if you'd like a full Russian translation, please tweet us.
Please tweet us. Absolutely.
Oh, TMA on HRN. Or visit our Facebook page and request a full Russian translation. Das svidaniya.
Is that something in Russian? Is that
yes, actually, it means yeah. goodbye.
It means goodbye.
Yeah.
Show's not
hello?
Over yet.
Well done.
How do I say hello? I'm still here. How do I say I'm still here? I'm still here. Just kidding.
How do you say tweet?
Of his law. Tweet.
Tweet. So tweet us.
Tweet us.
Tweet us, пожалуйста.
Tweet us, Natasha. Okay. Sorry.
That was please. That's okay.
All right, Sari,
okay,
what's your news?
Food news? Oh, the news. All right. So first of all, this is really important news. There's a donut in Philadelphia that looks like a barf donut, but it's not.
What does a barf donut mean?
Like, well, it's a donut that looks like it's got barf spilling out of it.
That's disgusting.
It's disgusting. It's actually not marketed to be a barf donut, although I'm sure that would have an amazing following. In fact, it's
amongst like 6-year-olds.
I can't believe that this is actually. I'm actually upset here because I'm actually from Philadelphia.
I haven't even told you the story.
But it already sounds like a barf donut. This is.
I know. I told you it's right. Really okay. Asinine news. It's important. It's a donut that is it's filled with fresh chicken breast, smothered in a buttery buffalo sauce inside of a donut, topped with crumbled blue cheese. It's available only at PYT. In Philadelphia, and I saw the photo, and it looks like a donut is barfing.
Oh, wait, PYT is in, like, Pretty Young Thing?
I don't know what it stands for. That's the name of the restaurant. Do you know it?
Never heard of it.
Never heard of it. PYT. Well, I just put it on the map.
I mean, a cheesesteak kind of looks like a sub barfing, right?
Well, cheese made with cheese whiz, that would make it might make anybody barf.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is like a signature thing in Philadelphia.
No, I just wanted, I think maybe we've gone too far with our donut fillings. I think it's time to draw it back in.
I do as well. I mean, I'm a glazed donut girl, or maybe just the sugar donut. Erin Sylvester is also in studio today to comment on anything she wants to. Erin, what are the donuts with the sugar on them called?
Sugar donuts.
Sugar donuts.
Sorry, Erin.
Crullers are good.
The one thing. What's a cruller like?
They're lighter. They're lighter. And actually, you know, the Pennsylvania Dutch, you in Philadelphia, you do get those, and they can be delicious.
Well, I don't know if savory donut is okay.
I'm personally not super into the sweet savory combination. As in, waffles with, like, a fried chicken inside.
I don't know if we need to put chicken breast and blue cheese inside a donut.
No.
I agree.
Does that really elevate the cuisine?
This does not advance our world.
It does not advance our world, and especially when the result is a donut that looks like it's barfing. I don't think that makes the world a better place.
I second that, Sari.
I'm not kumbayaing that today.
No.
Okay. So, a solution for those potato chip bags that we all know are mostly filled with air, and it's so infuriating because you buy a bag of chips and you open it up and there's like 7 chips. Coming out of South Korea today, not today, recently, students have built a raft out of the potato chips to prove a point that they are mostly air and they are, in fact, inflatable.
Wait, they're like floating,
they're floating
a river?
Yes. So the Korea Times reports that these four ingenious students have built a raft using 160 bags of Orion potato chips as building materials. And they took the raft, or a dinghy, as they're calling it, on a 1.3-kilometer trip while being escorted? Escorted.
Escorted.
Hello. By a police boat. And I there is a video online. You can Google this. It's on First We Feast. And there's two guys, like, in this little raft. And they are going places. And it's built entirely out of potato chips. So I think they're really sticking it to the potato chip man in Korea.
I was trying to think of, like, potato chip slogans. And then I guess, like, Lay's, you can't have just one. But that's not significant. I was hoping that it said they were less filling or something.
I think that's just, like, a general phenomenon. Not just chips. I mean,
anything in a bag like that?
And not just potato chips, but, yeah, all kinds of those kind of snacky thingies.
Well, I guess it's, I mean, obviously a great snack to have on a boat, because if you drop it overboard, it's just going to float. You can just grab it.
Well, that is really useful.
That's probably what they've intended all along.
Well, it seems to me that they might want to have a regulation to require that a certain that ships, you know, think about ships, you know, somebody capsizes, have a certain number of bags of potato chips, so God forbid something happens and everybody just grabs bags of potato chips to use as flotation devices.
They now have this dual purpose, and we thank our friends in South Korea for figuring that out for us.
You both stay afloat, you stay afloat chips. And then you at least have something to eat.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? That's actually a good reason to get potato chips on airline, you know?
Yeah, highly resourceful. That's true. Do they do that? Oh, they have potato chips on most airlines. Sure. JetBlue's got the Terra chips going. Yeah. That's smart. I like that. Okay, so speaking of Asia, Japanese blue beer is now something that exists. And it's actually blue, and it's made from all natural ingredients. There's no food coloring in this. It is blue beer. It's made from melted icebergs, blue seaweed, and Chinese yam.
Wait, what? I'm sorry. Melted icebergs?
Melted icebergs.
And polar bear tears?
I don't think so. I mean, unless they've gotten into the...
Must have been blue algae.
It says blue seaweed. Could be, I'm sure, if not algae, a cousin of algae. I don't know. Polar bear tears might have gotten into those icebergs. I'm sure the polar bears cried as the icebergs melted.
Absolutely. But is there hop in there? Is there malt in there? Like, how is it beer?
You know, I'm not the expert. I'm just the messenger, Jesse. I would love to answer all your questions, but luckily you can find out, because the beer has been available in Japan for 5 years, but you can now order it online in America.
Yay.
There is a website, and it's sold in individual cans for $8 or in packs of 4 or 8. So apparently it does taste like beer. It doesn't taste like blue slushy, which is kind of disappointing. But I mean, you can make beer from yam, right?
Yeah, I guess you can't. You can make vodka from yam, probably. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. So they did that, and we can taste it. So thank you, Japan, for your innovation. And then the last thing I just wanted to mention, because this feels a little controversial to me. At Mission Chinese in San Francisco, they're now putting MSG shakers on the table. So I think there's this thing happening where it's like everyone was so freaked out about MSG, and then there's a certain population of, I don't know, restaurateurs and chefs who make Chinese food who are now saying MSG is fine. It's, you know, all this hype about it is a myth. And actually David Chang at the MAD Symposium gave a speech about how MSG, all the allergies are just myths, and it's just been hype. So I don't know. I was curious, like, would you guys use the MSG shakers? I don't know if they're in addition to MSG in the food, or it's just kind of like a seasoning preference thing.
Aaron?
I'll try anything once.
Okay.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same thing because, you know, growing up in Phoenix, where Chinese food, I'm sure, had MSG, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that I know anything different. So I'd be really interested to kind of do a comparison.
Yeah.
You know, have a little bit without it, have a little bit with it, see if I, you know, break out in hives.
It'd be interesting to test it for taste and also to see if there's any sort of physical reaction to mm-hmm. it. But I don't know. I'd be worried that then you're starting to, like, feel psychosomatic or something.
Well, the analogy is to sulfur in wine. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I certainly think, you know, MSG is supposed to be a flavor enhancer. And I know, you know, also me growing up, not knowing anything about MSG, I'm sure it was in the Chinese food, the so-called Chinese food that I ate. I would absolutely try with, try without. But my own cynicism is such that, and knowing that many of the arguments about sulfur are muddled and misguided, because I will argue that for the vast majority of wines, sulfur is actually a necessity, but for hygienic reasons.
But aren't there specific people who have sulfur allergies? It's not like everybody has. It's very limited. Okay.
The reason that sulfur was regulated in the United States had more to do with a prohibitionist movement that was sponsored largely by Strom Thurmond, a wonderful late senator from South Carolina. But the aim was to, it was put on as a scare tactic to keep people from drinking wine. And now people then think that sulfur is bad when it's a much more complicated issue. And in some ways, sulfur, so long as we're, now I'll get technical for a moment, but the overwhelming majority of wine grapes in the world are very susceptible to various fungal diseases and mildews. And you need sulfur to control that. And if you don't have that, you're not going to have the grapes get ripe, and most of the wines are actually going to fall apart by the, if you want to buy wines from Europe and keep them for a long time, as an example, if you want to buy wines that are made 50 miles away from where you, more than 50 miles away from where you live, you're going to need some degree of sulfur in your wine, which is also, not to mention the fact that sulfur is a natural byproduct of the fermentation process. There's sulfur in every wine. It's imperceptible, but it's natural. But it's natural. But so anyway, the labeling is a scare tactic.
But MSG is not a natural byproduct.
No, to be clear.
So that, I think that's where the big difference.
That's a big distinction.
Yeah, right. And I know that. I mean, I've eaten Chinese food before, and had what I think was a reaction to MSG, where I had a horrible headache the next day, felt hungover, even if I hadn't, you know, been drinking. So I don't know. Who can say?
I've had a horrible reaction to baked apples. I can't eat cooked apples. But does that mean that baked and cooked apples are bad?
Yes.
No, that's just me.
Oh.
I love them. I think they're delicious, but not for my body.
Okay.
I mean, I guess with for me, when something's called a flavor enhancer, I'm like, why can't you just make food that's delicious enough on its own? That's kind of my perception. That's what comes into my own brain when I
well
when
sure I,
think about I
mean
MSG.
You and I both come from the school of, you know, food should be real food,
but then there's the four-letter word salt,
sure,
which is a flavor enhancer in good many point. Ways
good point.
Oh goodness,
I see that
we
okay
have opened
I'm
a Pandora's
some,
box.
I'm gonna try some MSG absolutely after the break.
Right after the break. call San Francisco.
Let's do it.
Danny Bowen, get over here.
We're gonna come right back on the morning after with Lisa Granick, Master of Wine. They always do that on the morning after. This is the morning.
You're listening to Mood Swings by Cloud.
Thank you. The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back here on The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I am still Sarah Kamen.
She has a doctorate in law, is a master of wine, speaks fluent Russian, and is helping to stage a tasting in New York City of what is likely the oldest winemaking culture in the world. That would be the country of Georgia. Lisa Granick, MW, welcome to The Morning After.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
So
that was impressive.
Before I get to the question of why did you even want to do more schooling as in to get a Master of Wine, I just kind of want to know right out the gate, can you clarify for listeners what becoming a Master of Wine entails?
Sure.
How is it different than becoming a sommelier?
Okay. Well, being a sommelier is a job. Okay. And there is a series of programs to become a Master Sommelier. There are different stages for that, and it's a very challenging exam involving memorization of all the different wine regions of the world and, to some degree, how wines are made and so forth. The Master of Wine program is different. You don't just say, I'm going to enter the MS program or I'm going to enter the MW program. So both of them require preliminary work. For the Master of Wine program, it requires at least 5 years of professional experience in the wine industry. And then by the time you are entering or apply to the MW program, you already need to know the grape varieties of the world, how wines are made, what the terroirs are like. There's a lot of knowledge that you have to have under your belt, because by the time you enter the MW program, you need to be able to blind taste wines from all over the world and be able to identify what the grape variety is, where they were from, what the vintage might be, and so forth. And that's a constant practice. To become an MW, once you're accepted in the program, there are three parts to the MW exam. You're in the program for at least 2 years before you can sit the exam. And the first part is the exam, actually the closed book exam takes it is 4 days long, as I recall. And the first 3 days in the morning, each day, traditionally, it's the blind tasting, what we call the practical. So day one is traditionally white wines. Day two would be red wines. And day three would be anything. I mean, now for my year, I remember, two pairs. There were two Bordeaux and two Burgundy. A flight of sparkling wines, which included the cava, champagne, I forget what else, and two different champagnes because there was different quality levels, and then four different sweet wines, Madeira, sherry, a sweet wine, a noble sweet wine from Australia, and maybe, did I say Sauternes? I can't remember.
No,
so 12 wines. And you have, for each day, you have 12 wines, and you have 2 hours and 15 minutes to answer the questions about the wine. And they're in groups, and you have to identify what the grape variety is, where the wines were grown, how they were made, what the vintages might have been, what the residual sugars might be, and so forth and so on. It is a more analytical approach. You identify the grape or the wine, and then you make an argument as to why, how to support your conclusion. They say for the MW exam, you need to think like a detective and write like a lawyer. So that's the 3 days of the blind tasting.
It's like taking the bar while drinking.
I'm going to tell you something. It's harder than the bar exam since I've done it. So then in the afternoons, there then are essays on grape growing, winemaking, and all aspects of winemaking, from everything from harvest through the malolactic fermentation and then the chemistry of wine. Ultimately, then there's a day on essays on the business of wine, quality control, quality assurance, and then a longer series of essays on what we call contemporary issues, which might be the role of the impact of journalism and scores and bloggers or labor movements and wine and so forth and so on. So, but it, you know, it's a 4-day exam, and you have to pass all of the practical, and you can be a half. There's no such thing as a half pass, but you're able to, if you pass all the papers of the practical, the tasting, you've gotten that under your belt. But if you fail one, you fail, and then there's for the all of the papers, the 5 papers of the theory. You have to pass all 5, all of those. Though if you, with the theory, if you fail like one part, you're allowed to just retake one part out of the 5. But once you've passed both the practical and theory, there then is a research paper that's required, and that's an independent research project. That's typically about a 40-page paper on some individual topic to advance our knowledge of wine that you find interesting.
So, I mean... Being an MW is a more academic approach to the wine world.
Well, you know, the MS is service-oriented. I mean, it's for people who are going to work in restaurants. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have the analytical approach. For the motto of the MW is that the more that we understand wine, the more we actually enjoy it. And certainly I have found that while my approach in studying for the MW allowed me to learn a lot about the wine trade, in all of its aspects, because, you know, most of us work in one field, or we've worked in one or two. You know, we work in restaurants or retail, and then we work for an importer. The MW really allows you to see you take a global view, and you see how, you know, the history of wine, academic makes it sound like it's very dry and not relevant to society, but in fact, remember, there's a whole section, not only is there a whole day of questions on the business of wine, when you're writing in the theory papers about how wine is made and how grapes are grown and how wine is made, you have to think about the business aspects of it. Because, other than the amount of wine in the world that's made to be drunk at home, the overwhelming amount of wine is made for one purpose, and that is to be sold before it's even drunk. And a lot of it doesn't even necessarily get drunk, right? So it forces you – there actually is a – practical element of thinking why, what is the purpose of this wine and what's gone into its production to make it saleable and how do we sell it?
You have a law degree. You were teaching at Georgetown. You ended up on a Fulbright scholarship going to Russia and getting your doctorate in law there. Why go into wine and why not stay a lawyer?
Because you've
worked very hard to learn a lot of stuff about law.
I was teaching at Georgetown. I was a practicing lawyer. Actually, I was doing child defense work. I was a public interest lawyer. And I knew I had more... I wanted to be a full-time law professor and not just... actually, being a child advocate there was a lot of burnout. It was a very stressful job. And I won this Fulbright to teach... At Moscow University, actually. And the Soviet Union was falling apart. And at that time, which was 89, 90, you needed what they called an invitation to actually get to the country. It didn't matter, you know, what it was. But and the Soviet Union, the Soviet government was ossifying. I mean, nothing was working, and the bureaucracy was falling apart. And while the Fulbright was accepted, they wouldn't issue the invitation. And I had a friend who was at Moscow University who said, if you can get yourself to the Soviet Union, you can find somebody else to get you that invitation, we can then get you to Moscow. And so I had a number of years earlier done some work with some Georgian lawyers, and they were thrilled at the notion of having me come to teach at the Institute of State and Law in Tbilisi. So they issued the invitation, and I went to Georgia. It was actually not until I then spent that year in Georgia and for a short period of time in Moscow that I actually went back to Yale, actually, and that's where I got my doctorate. But it was en route to a full-time academic position until I then decided that I didn't want to be a law professor anymore.
Wow. So
you are one of the most impressive people we've definitely ever had in the studio, I have to say.
Over-educated, underemployed, one could also argue. Oh, but
I think a lot of people probably feel that way.
No kidding.
I'm just curious, how many master winemakers are there?
Masters of wine,
Masters
you mean?
Masters of wine.
I'm sorry, yes.
Or do you
There's
mean,
a lot of master winemakers.
No,
there are.
MWs.
Right, no, there are, because we just added another 5 or 6 in September, because the announcement is once a year. And I want to say there are 317 in the world. And you will see the tide shifting. While originally, and while the center of gravity still is London, because when you think about it, until recently, England had no, they didn't grow wine in England, they didn't make wine in England. They traded wine and they bought wine, certainly for the Queen or the King, whoever it might have been. So the wine trade was extremely important as traders, and the MW was established to professionalize and add a. It is sort of like a bar of the bar exam. Or the medical boards for the wine trade. Mm-hmm. And there are, while it was centered in the UK, it was, I don't remember, the first non-UK member of the Institute was Michael Hill Smith, who's an Australian, and that was in the late 80s, maybe 88. Then there were two Americans in 1991, Mary Mulligan then was the first female American master of wine in maybe 1993. And now there have been a few deaths, because the first MW, I want to say, was somewhere in the early 50s, 1954 or so, and we're at about 317 today.
So your time spent in Georgia, I imagine, introduced you to Georgian wine. What was your first impression?
Well, actually, my first understanding of Georgian wine came as a student of Russian at university, where... we had this, you learn situational dialogues, and you go to the post office, and what do people say? You go to somebody's house, and you get these dialogues, and it was a Russian book, and it was amazing when I first went to Russia, because everybody was talking right out of the book. I mean, it was almost like it was canned. Hello, very nice to meet you. What is your name? And anyway, in the restaurant episode, people sit down. May I sit? They're at a table. May I sit? Yes, we're at a table for four, please. Here is your menu. Thank you very much. Can I get you something while you're waiting? Yes, we'd like a good glass of wine, please. May I suggest a Georgian wine? Yes, we would like a, and then it went on, and it was all about a Georgian wine, and they named that style of wine, which was a Tsinandali. It's a very famous wine. And so I knew about Georgian wine before, 10 years, well before I ever went to Georgia, because in Russia, while the largest importer or exporter of wine, or the largest supplier, this time it was the Soviet Union, while Moldova produced the greatest volume of wine, it was Georgia that was always regarded as producing the greatest wine in the Soviet Union. And actually, the history of Georgian wine and the awards that Georgian wines won in Western Europe extended back into the 1800s. So they actually were relatively well-known, even if not in this country.
So for the campaign of Georgian wine that you're working on right now, the slogan is 8,000 vintages. So that means, correct?
Right.
Like, so here, Georgian wine is supposed to be one of the oldest winemaking cultures
indeed,
in the world.
Indeed. There's a bit of a fight right now. There's a little bit of a competition. There are lots of countries trying to say that they are the birthplace of wine, whether you want to say, and there's, I will say, an MW colleague of mine, Joel Butler, has written a book called, I can't remember what it's called, but Ancient Vintages or something, and it's the history of wine. And he has a colleague with whom he's written the wine, or with whom he's written the book. Sorry, but we don't know exactly where wine was domesticated, whether it was Eastern Turkey or Georgia or Armenia, actually. But what distinguishes Georgia from all of those countries is that, A, we have very clear evidence that there were wild vines and the vine was domesticated in both, the Bronze and the Neolithic Age. There's physical evidence that's been found. And what distinguishes Georgia from those other areas is that it was pagan, and then it became Christian in 334. And has never been Islamic, while it has been overrun by the Turks from the east and the south, and the Persians from the west. I'm sorry, Persians from the east. It's a Christian country, and that history of winemaking has been continuous for 8,000 vintages, and that's what really. We'll see. There's increasing evidence that Georgia really is the birthplace, or at least the cradle of wine, but certainly that it's gone on for 8,000 years.
I want to take a break here. Let everyone think about that. We'll come back, talk more about Georgian wine with Lisa Granick, MW. This is The Morning After.
When you travel in a book I mentioned, don't forget your remote control. Experience destination, a book with a traveling soul.
You're listening to Down to Earth by Eric Maltz.
Daisy Martinez, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After. In studio today, Lisa Granick, MW. We are talking about Georgian wine, and she is helping to stage the, I'm going to call it monumental tasting, the most Georgian wines ever brought to be tasted in New York City tomorrow.
It is actually the first Georgian wine tasting ever held in the United States.
Why now? What's the occasion surrounding this?
Well, actually, it's been planned for a while, but curiously, yesterday was the first ever National Wine Day. It was declared the National Wine Day in Georgia.
Oh, because of Yom Kippur?
Yeah, very funny. I know, I was wondering about that one too. But October 4th, from now on, is going to be National Wine Day in Georgia, which all my Georgian friends thought was hilarious because they said, what do you mean National Wine Day? In Georgia, we have 365 National Wine Days a year.
Yeah.
Because the culture is so, wine is so embedded in the culture and its history. But actually, the reason for this initiative is that Georgia really wants to look westward. Mm-hmm. And I was going to go into this a little bit later, but I'll do it now. 93% to 95% of all of the grapes, the wine grapes grown in Georgia, are grown by tiny family farms that are basically somewhere between 3 and 5 acres each. Incredibly fragmented. You're talking about people living at subsistence level. So any Georgian wine that you buy, you are supporting very small growers, people living at often semi-subsistence level, but you're really supporting individual people rather than big companies. And it doesn't matter which Georgian wine, because everybody is buying wines or grapes from these small farmers. And Georgia is really intent on these, while they are at the crossroads of East and West, at root they really want to be Western. And while and we'll get into the Russian issue in a minute. I'll get into it now because Georgia. When we in the States, we look at Georgia and we only see it from recent period. And it was part of the Soviet Union, but in fact, when you think about 8,000 vintages, number one, the Georgian people are a collection of tribes, and unlike other people, I mean, I come from a group of people that has a diaspora throughout the world, and we've been all over the place. The Georgians have come from there. They've never gone anywhere. I mean, there are some Georgians who've left, but Georgia is, they have always been where they are, and that tradition is something that they've always had. And they've had their culture, and they've never had, and if you look at the map, the northern border is a series of the Caucasus Mountains. Georgia never had anything to do with Russia. They were always invaded, as I was saying earlier, by the Persians or the Turks. They never had anything to do with Russia until 1801, when they were annexed into the Russian Empire. So you're really talking about 1801 to 1990, not even 200 years, that Russia and Georgia had a connection. Georgia is really has nothing to do with Russian. The language has nothing to do with Russian. It's completely different. It is hard for us to conceive how completely different and singular and extraordinary Georgia is, and how different they are from Russians. And they don't want to be dominated by the Russians. And while, of course, Russia wants to dominate Georgia, therefore, for this is one of the things when you talk about, again, what makes an MW different. We don't just look at how to sell wine in a restaurant or how to serve it and how it goes with food, but the geopolitics of wine. And in this instance, with every bottle of Georgian wine that you purchase and enjoy, and I hope there will be many, you are supporting Georgia to look west and to encouraging Georgia to export more to the west rather than have it be subservient to Vladimir Putin. And all of Russia.
So I think let's get into the characteristics of Georgian wine, and
in that sense, you know, you're voting with your mouth and your stomach, you know,
exactly. Absolutely. So that people can be even more encouraged to buy Georgian wine. Yeah. I mean, what are the main characteristics of the grapes and the winemaking style?
Well, it's hard. First of all, it's hard to say because. And when you think in terms of the impact, like why now? This is something that we're really only discovering. Why now is also, it's the collapse. The Soviet Union has collapsed, and the Georgian wine market is only now beginning to resurrect itself. And there are 4,000 grape varieties worldwide. Over 525 of those are Georgian. Okay, they're all over the place, and there are teams of people who go out. They realize that they don't even know how many vines they have because, again, all these different farmers, people have individual vines in their backyard, and they're still trying to identify the vines. There's an experimental vineyard where they're planting different, I'll say clones, but cuttings that they found from unique varieties. And a lot of those varieties weren't grown in volume in the past 100-odd years, and so the vines that have been planted recently are young. And so you're talking about many different grape varieties. Right? Let's just say even if there are 525, there are 40-odd that are you really see right now. And a lot of the historical memory has been blotted out. Now there are whites, reds, rosés, okay? And the wines are primarily made in a couple of different ways. There are wines, you know, European winemaking was introduced in Georgia in the, I want to say, basically the 1800s in a couple of areas of the country. There were a couple of Frenchmen who came and a Scotsman who came to the West and introduced, neutral fermentations and oak barrels and the like. And even now, stainless steel tanks, they have a lot of very pretty Italian stainless steel tanks. There's been a lot of Italian investment in Georgia. And so you have what we would call, you know, traditional European winemaking that really highlights the characteristic of the grape variety where there is no oak. It's purely neutral. And right now, the white varieties range from wines that taste, grape varieties that are sort of, you know, aperitifs. They're like Pinot Grigios or like Grunerfeldliners. Some are fruity. Some have flavors of, you know, wild flowers and herbs, some melon and dried apricot. Depends on the grape variety, whether you're talking about Cazzatelli or Svane, lots of, you know, sometimes some melon characters. The most and 70% of the production in Georgia traditionally has been white wine. The number one grape variety is the wine that I poured for us today, which is the Saporavi. And almost all of the Georgian grape varieties the names actually mean something. And in this case, Saparavi, which is a Tenserye grape variety, which means that you can't make a white wine from it. The juice itself is pink, okay?
Which is incredibly rare.
Very rare. And Saparavi, the sape, actually means something to dye with or to color with, like dye with your hair, not
D-Y-E.
D-Y-E, right. And it has to do with how inky it is. And you can just take a young, very young glass of Cabernet Sauvignon, or Syrah, which we think of as being very deep, and compare it to a young Saparavi, and cannot imagine how deep and dark and inky this wine would be. The reds vary, because one of the interesting things about the reds is that they can be dry, like the Saparavi. It's depending on, it's terroir driven, so if it's grown up closer to the mountains, it will be more aromatic and elegant with elegant berry fruits. And if it's grown further away from the mountain in a warmer climate, there's more of a meaty, licorice, supple tannin with slightly higher alcohol. But Georgian wines don't have very high alcohol levels. I mean, the range is more between, I would say, 11 to 14. They don't get up into the high alcohols of 15 and 16 that you see in this country. And then there are some of the really interesting wines, apart from the dry reds, are the semi-sweet reds, where they're very fruity on the attack, and you take them in the mouth, but they're tannic. And they do have residual sugar. I mean, they are sweet, but then because the acidity is so high, and I can't say that the tannins are grippy, but there's a very tannic bite to it. The finish is very dry, and it goes brilliantly with Caribbean cuisine and spicy foods. It's really, really interesting. So those are the wines that are made by modern methods. But a lot of what's put Georgia on the map is what's known as the Kvevri, or in the western part of Georgia, it's called the Churi. And that is a large clay vessel, which I can't translate into gallons, and no one really knows what the size is anyway. But it's a relatively large vessel that is put into the ground. And people think of it as an amphora, but an amphora is a later development in Western Europe, in Greece and Italy, or in Rome. And the amphora was primarily used for transport and storage, whereas the Kvevri is made for fermentation. And both red and white wines are fermented in Kvevri. And what are most distinctive, or most what a lot of people have been interested in lately, are the white wines, or the so-called amber wines, that are made in Kvevri. The wine that we're having today actually is a Kvevri wine. It was fermented in Kvevri. The white wines are distinctive because if they come from the eastern part of Georgia, typically white wines in contemporary production, you take the stems and the skins off of the grapes and just the juice is fermented. But in this instance, the stems, a certain proportion of the stems and the skins and the seeds, everything is chucked into the Kvevri and left there for 6 months until the spring, and everything ferments together. And so you have a white wine that in some ways, if you tasted it blind, feels like a red wine. And they have very chalky tannins, and they're very singular. I mean, it is a tradition that goes back 8,000 years.
And I will say that in my wine education, I think of these amber wines as orange wine, and the fact that it is slightly a trend at the moment. I know Ruth Lewandowski making wine, orange wine in California, and then Channing Daughters is making orange wine in the North Fork.
It's an 8,000-year-old trend.
And why do the Georgians not want to call it orange wine?
Right, because we had this discussion earlier. First of all, I mean, there's a problem. Sometimes people think, and I've heard people ask, I can't think of other wines, and people ask, it's when people say, you taste this wine, it tastes of raspberries and blackberry and licorice. And then people who don't know anything about wine say, oh, wow, did they make that wine with raspberry and licorice and so forth?
Yeah, that does happen.
They do. And so there is no orange. There's nothing orange in orange wine or in amber wine. That's number one. You want to get rid of that confusion. Secondly, not all so-called orange wines really are orange. They're more amber in color, and they vary. And an orange is, it's grapefruit. I love it. But it's a fruit. And whereas amber is a semi-precious stone. And I would like to think that wine, I don't like to be too precious about wine, but it is a precious stone, semi-precious, and amber has a variety of different colors. And amber wine, so that there's a greater tolerance for the different styles of amber wines. Some definitely have an orange hue, and some are brown. And so it is... I think there's both the allusion to the semi-precious stone and clarity that it has more to do with the color.
It feels more accurate.
That's and I don't know whether that's true, but that's certainly my understanding.
So the tasting is tomorrow at Astor Wines. How many wines are going to be presented?
I don't know exactly. Somewhere between 70, 80, something along those lines, from a variety of different producers. The only wines that we're showing are wines that are currently imported. There are many more fantastic wines made in Georgia that are not yet imported. And, you know, certainly Georgians are hoping that people will become excited about these wines and will demand not just these wines, but more wines, because I've had other really fantastic wines made by both, you know, contemporary European methods that I would argue show the real purity of the individual grape variety, because you're really capturing the fruit from the ground and having it go through the fermentation process, whereas Kvevri wines in some ways are more about the winemaking process than about the wine. Both are valid. Both are delicious. I love both of them, and I want people to have an open mind to all of them, because they all have different places and times on the table, and not necessarily just on the table. But there are more wines that we haven't seen here yet, and I'm hoping to stir enough interest that people will demand more of them.
Who's attending the tasting? Is it open to the public?
Or? It is. Right now, this one is strictly for people in the wine trade. Mm-hmm. People who own wine shops, wine educators, but anybody. There's press. We have a very broad definition of the trade, but people who are seriously interested in Georgian wine are welcome to come and experiment and see what there is to offer.
I'm excited to see Georgian wine all over New York City and beyond. Before we wrap this up, though, Lisa, I'm going to give you the morning after quiz.
Ah.
So, Lisa Granick, MW, you may know about the country of Georgia, but what do you know about the fourth U.S. state, Georgia? Prepare.
It's a commonwealth. It's not a state.
Oh, my God. She's going to kill me on this. I knew it. I was afraid. I was totally afraid. She's so much more educated than I am.
Than anyone else.
I just have a BA from Arizona State University.
Give up now, Jesse.
All right. Question one. You will be the first to ace this, I imagine.
Forget it.
Question one. What American new wave band was formed in Athens, Georgia in 1976? Was it A, the Cars? Was it B, the B-52s? Or was it C, Devo? Stumped look on her face. Stumped.
Yeah,
look.
Athens. I thought we were talking Indigo Girls or REM. So, hold on. So the Cars are from Boston.
The B-52s or Devo?
Possible. I'll go with the B-52s.
You are correct. You are correct. Nice. I mean, who else sings a song about butterbeans?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Question two. This plateau region that runs through the state of Georgia shares its name with what Italian wine appellation? Is it A, Piedmont? Is it B, Friuli Venezia Giulia? Or is it C, Umbria?
It's the Piedmont.
It's the Piedmont!
Killing it!
Lisa
Granick. This is unprecedented thus far.
It's also in North Carolina.
It is. I mean, it's. I think it actually stretches from New Jersey.
She answered your question and then raised you one.
I know. And apparently, there's a style of blues music called Piedmont blues.
Mm-hmm.
I am crippled. I am crushed.
I'm not going to get 100 on this quiz.
All right.
So it's okay.
All right.
There's only one more question.
I kind of hope you do. There is only one more question. All right. Question three, for all the gold. Which of these is not a body of water in Georgia? Is it A, the Okefenokee Swamp? Is it B, the Tittabawassee River? Or is it C, the Chattahoochee River? all amazing.
Speaking
all
of Indigo amazing. Girls.
Oh, Native American names are extraordinary. And I have no idea. What was the first swamp?
Okefenokee. B.
Okay.
So, Tittabawassee. Oh,
so I hear that term all the time. Does that really come from somewhere, the Okefenokee?
This is a multiple choice. I will not give you any answers.
So I'm
going to
say maybe the Okefenokee really came from somewhere, but I'll vote for that one.
So you say A, Okefenokee,
I'll
final
say
answer.
Because I have no clue.
It is actually the Tittabawassee River. It's not in Georgia.
Okay,
it's in Michigan, actually.
Who knew?
Oh, okay.
Me.
All right. But
you,
I mean,
passed
you,
the bar. You have...
two out of three ain't bad.
No, yeah. Absolutely. You did a fantastic job on this quiz. And I do think that number three was hard, and I only know it because I was just in Michigan last week. I saw the Tittabawassee River. Lisa Grinnick, thank you so much. Do you have Twitter, Instagram, and all that stuff?
I have a website.
Twitter, yeah. And a website.
Well, GrannickMW, at GrannickMW. And GrannickMW is also the website. I need to update a little more often, but there we are.
All right. Thank you so much for being on The Morning After.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, and I hope everybody's intrigued enough to experiment with Georgian wines because they're delicious. And I'm going to say they're only going to get better because the vines right now are relatively young, and they're only going to get more and more flavorful and more interesting.
Sari Kamen, I'll talk to you soon.
See ya.
This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.